You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Walcock.
So it looks like we're getting closer to an election, and therefore all the calculations about which type of voter needs to be massaged more in order to deliver at the election. The group of voters that has always been high on the agenda has been the grey vote. That is anyone, of course, old enough to get their pension or perhaps within sort of shooting distance of their pension. Now, the elderly have long been a Conservative Party bedrock. Yesterday, the Chancellor made an announcement which proves that they are still front and centre for the party, Hunt telling the BBC that the triple lock on pensions will be in the Conservative Party manifesto. And he's confident that the growing economy will be able to pay for that.
It's not a cheap commitment by any stretch of the word, Caroline, but it does speak to, just as you were saying, the way that age now plays into politics. And possibly one of the biggest determinants of how you vote is your age. And it's something that wasn't the case 40 years ago.
No, absolutely. The intergenerational issue, I think, is enormous. And it is simply highlighted by the fact that a Labour spokesperson has said that the Labour Party is committed to retaining the state pension triple lock too.
But again, that instantly neutralises the Conservatives' threat in terms of electoral political polling, but yet ties Labour in yet a tighter bind in terms of their fiscal position going forward.
So let's dig into then a bit more about the grey vote, the importance of it on the programme, and think about the specifics of the triple lock and what it means for the UK economy. Well, joining us now is the president of the Resolution Foundation, Lord David Willetts. Welcome back to Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for your time. The triple lock brought pensioners out of poverty. Surely it's a good idea to keep it.
Well, I agree it's helped bring pensioners out of poverty. It's set a new level for the basic state pension, now the new single-tier pension, significantly higher than it was before. But that's actually a reason why we don't need to keep it, because it's delivered what it was supposed to achieve. It's delivered a step change. It can't carry on indefinitely. And now that pensioners are less likely to be poor than working age families, it doesn't seem to me right that we should carry on with this very expensive pledge.
If you were to rewrite it then, Lord Willetts, what would it look like? Would it mean working to 70? Would it be more means tested?
Well, I think there are several things you should do. Clearly, what has happened is in the period when the basic pension was only linked to prices, it fell behind earnings. And now it has caught up in its ratio to earnings. It's about a third of earnings. And now I think this pension should be broadly linked to earnings. And the same should be true of other benefits for families. Whereas what's happened at the moment with the triple lock is that pensions have been dynamized and have risen by either inflation or earnings or 2.5%, whichever is higher. So it's pushed them up. They've risen by more than earnings. Whilst meanwhile, there are some family benefits that haven't even kept pace with earnings. I think a broad link to earnings, you could have some short-term flexibility, but a broad link to earnings is the right way to do it.
Okay. Conservative politicians don't agree. Is this just a policy because we're going into a general election? There are 12 million people who get the state pension. But as you say, 8.5% increase in April this year, more than 10% increase in April last year. Is this just necessary in order to win the Grey vote?
Well, I think that the political significance of the Grey vote is what lies behind this. But we had some recent evidence at the Resolution Foundation, which showed actually there are increasing numbers of old people who are worried about the prospects for their children and grandchildren, and who say that their vote will be swayed by what they see as the best help for the younger generation. And look, sometimes people claim that I'm a sort of generational warrior. I'm not a generational warrior. I want a fair deal for each generation. And at the moment, I think there are many old people themselves who can see that if you are committing to this level of public spending on pensions, other services for other age groups could suffer. And look, the IFS estimate and the OBR in their latest forecasts have shown that the triple lock and pension spending over the next parliament could rise by £40 billion, from something over £100 billion to approaching £150 billion. That is a very significant expenditure commitment when, as we all know, fiscal pressures are going to remain very tough.
Yes, and I've heard that from older people, you know, who are concerned, for example, about housing and education for their relations and younger generations. But the thing is, that is people who might be claiming a state benefit now. We have an aging population, the end of defined benefit pension schemes, and also more older people expected to rent their homes in the next couple of decades. So actually there's going to be more pressure to keep a kind of better state pension provision actually going, no?
Well, there may be issues down the track, but what we're really talking about is issues for the next parliament. At the moment, it's very clear that because most pensioners are homeowners with the mortgage paid off, that means that they are not susceptible to the pressures of high rents or high interest rates. And indeed, I remember my conversations around the cabinet table when in coalition we brought in the triple lock. And I was a skeptic about it then. And one of the answers I got was that in the post-crash world, with interest rates so low, pensioners with savings were suffering from very low interest rates. And one of the justifications of the triple lock was to compensate them for that. We're now in an environment where interest rates are significantly higher. That means that there are extra tens of billions of pounds of income going to savers who have got bank deposits, building society deposits. That's really helping pensioners. So at the moment, we've got to deal with the world as it is. And in the world as it is, pensioners are less likely to be poor than families, and they have after housing costs, median incomes that are higher than families. So it doesn't seem to me a priority use of a limited budget at the moment.
You point out that this was an announcement targeted at the next election. And we also sort of know that this is something that's targeted at people with a grey vote. Would you say this is a scorched earth policy, Lord Willis?
I think that would be harsh. I mean, the Chancellor has, I mean, practicing politicians, and I now operate from the safety of the House of Lords. I'm no longer a constituency MP. I completely understand the political pressures that practicing politicians who are doing their best to win the next election are under. But I had hoped that neither party would have a pledge on triple lock in their manifesto, and that in turn would give them the kind of room for manoeuvre that either an incoming Labour or a remaining Conservative government would need. The triple lock is a very expensive pledge, and the danger is it squeezes out expenditure on other things that are high priority. So I regret the decision, but I understand the political pressures that may have led to it.
So then would you agree with the fact that neither Labour nor Conservative have accepted to compensate the plea of WASPI women, this is the Women Against State Pension Inequality, from getting, you know, compensation or an extra payout because of the move to increase the pension age that they feel, you know, affected them unfairly because it wasn't communicated properly. You agree that that shouldn't be done?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting you should raise this, because actually these two issues are linked. Because when the coalition decided to go for the triple lock on pensions and faced the question of how to fund this very expensive commitment, one of the things that ministers decided was to speed up the raising of the female pension age in order to help fund it. And so these very expensive commitments, like for the triple lock, bring with them a whole host of quite awkward follow-up issues around how it should be financed. Now, I think from the Ombudsman's report, there clearly was a failure going right back decades to communicate the plan that was anyway there to raise the female pension age. But it was the coalition government actually had a plan, which was higher benefits for pensioners, partly financed by speeding up the increase in the state pension age.
I'm curious if you're concerned about the broader picture developing here as we go into the election, Lord Willetts, where both major parties seem to be almost kind of egging each other into a game of fiscal brinksmanship. I mean, you talk about the sort of the room for manoeuvre being narrowed. I was reading your sort of Stagnation Nation report recently, talk about the sort of radical changes the Resolution Foundation would like to see in how we look at pensions, growth, etc. Do you think both parties are narrowing their room for manoeuvre far too much and possibly being unwise in how they do that going into the election?
I think one of the reasons why I regret this decision is I do think it reduces room for manoeuvre, and I think it's going to be a very tough fiscal position for several years to come. I mean, look, I'm a fiscal conservative. We're still talking at the moment of a level of public borrowing of about £100 billion a year. Now, fortunately, the budget forecasts show that falling quite sharply. Nevertheless, we've still got high levels of borrowing. There will be, I think, real fiscal pressures building, and the more expensive spending pledges there are, the harder it'll be to manage our way through the next few years. And I would much rather both parties level with the electorate that money is very tight because we haven't been able to get the kind of growth rates we want to see, and then set out their plans for how to do that. And the Chancellor has done with measures such as full expensing of capital, so that capital investment, business investment, gets very favourable tax reliefs, has shown what he would do. But I think getting the growth going so that we might be able to spend money on programmes like this in the future is far better than making the spending commitments before it's clear that they can all be afforded.
Yeah, look, far from levelling with anyone, I mean, the fiscal rules have allowed us, you know, to live in a slightly kind of fantastical world in terms of the UK's government budget. Do you think that looking at the lack of public investment in recent years, that is an issue with the fiscal rules? Have they actually helped or hindered the UK economy?
Well, that is a deep question. I think you could imagine going back to the old fashioned fiscal rule of a balanced budget on current and borrowing for capital. Of course, that would, in certain scenarios over the past few years, have actually led to tighter fiscal policy than we've had. I know from my experience around the cabinet table, often the Treasury were trying to get capital spending up, and you often find that actually delivering, getting the money spent on the programme, getting it out the door and delivering real capital investment is itself a great problem in the UK, which we touch on in Stagnation Nation, just the time it takes, the difficulties of spending the money effectively. But yeah, our economic inquiry 2030 concluded that one of Britain's key problems is we're a low saving, low investment country, and we need to be a high saving, high investment country. That has some uncomfortable messages, that there's less money available for consumption and there's less money available for tax cuts. So I would hope that those type of very realistic messages about what we can actually afford to do are heard in part of the coming election campaign.
You came in 2010 in a very difficult fiscal inheritance from the Labour government and proceeded as part of that government to reform and change the public sector. Having done that election process, do you feel Labour are withholding a lot of policy at the moment? I understand the manifesto isn't out yet, but do you think more will be coming? We see a lot of Labour strategists effectively briefing the press saying, why not figure out, review things after the election and look at policy then? Do you think that would be unwise?
Well, in my experience, the work you do before you are elected is really important because it's actually, you have a bit more time in opposition than in government. In government, there's so many things just happening around you that the more you've got prior work that you can draw on and a prior kind of established view of your priorities that can shape what you do, the better. And look, the Shadow Chancellor in her May's lecture last week, she tried to set out the outlines of that. But I do hope that in the months ahead, we do get more detail.
What would you like to see in that detail? What are there any kind of specific policies or things you would like expect to be there?
Well, she says she wants to work with business and promote investment. How would they actually do that? I think that's really important. And look, I actually do believe that green investment is a high priority. I do think it's both an obligation and an opportunity. Where that program now stands, after Labour's retreat on that, and how they plan to spend that, I think that would be really worth hearing. And also, if either party has a long-term plan for how the benefit system should work, and as I say, we at Resolution have proposed a basic rule of a broad earnings link for both people of working age and pensioners. If that's not to be it, what is it to be? Yeah, those type of issues. And to be fair to them, I do think government ministers and opposition politicians do think about those type of questions, but they're very wary of getting into too much detail. And if they don't want detail to be revealed to the public, it's probably safer not to have it in private. That's the danger, that over the next few months, we have a debate that doesn't really surface the big challenges facing Britain.
Yeah, and there are many of those big challenges. I mean, a last thought, if you would, on the housing crisis, which is another major kind of generational issue, an issue around investment, and also an issue that I would say is about vested interests. I mean, you know, the Resolution has a new report out just today talking about how the UK's housing stock offers much worse value for money than other advanced economies. There's not enough floor space and it's not energy efficient and it's old and cramped and so on. I mean, it's really ghastly reading. But the issue and the reason that the Conservatives haven't managed to tackle it and Labour has made this one big pledge about building more homes is the fact that it means knocking down the vested interests. I mean, why are Labour going to be any different than the Tories in trying to get through the NIMBYs, the planners, and also the house builders to actually deliver on something like this?
Yeah, and look, and our report shows things like that. The living space, especially the living space occupied by younger adults, is actually shrinking. I mean, the world is supposed to get better for people. It is. We're an advanced Western economy, but the living space of young people is less than it was 20 years ago, and that is a scandal. I believe there is a cross-generation appeal here, and that it goes back to this issue of the triple lock as well. I want to see a Conservative Party that appeals to people across the generations, and that means being bold on getting more housing done. I think that's Michael Gove's instinct, but it gets frustrated. I think Labour are trying to be bold on housing. The danger is that we have this stark generational politics. At the moment, compared with 30 years ago, the age divide has become more and more significant in politics, with the Conservative Party appealing particularly to older voters and the Labour Party appealing particularly to younger voters. That is bad. much better to battle with the vested interests by saying, as I used to do as a constituency MP, look, you know, the older people who own your own home today, those houses were built on green fields 30 or 40 years ago for you. We have a similar obligation to do for your kids or grandchildren what previous generations did for you. It is a shared project. We have, speaking as a baby boomer myself, we have an obligation to ensure that future generations have the same opportunities to get a decent house and buy a house as we enjoyed. That's all we're asking for. And that's what every generation owes to its successors.
I'm sure those generational divides and the economics that underline them will be coming up in the future months as we head into whenever this general election is. President of the Resolution Foundation, Lord David Willett, thank you very much for joining us on the UK Politics Podcast today. Well, the triple lock policy might be garnering votes amongst the elderly, but the Conservative Party may still have some way to go in terms of popularity themselves. Bloomberg analysis is showing that Conservative candidates are not mentioning their own party in campaign ads posted on social media, actively distancing themselves from the National Party. That's according to a Bloomberg News review of Facebook posts listed in Meta's ads library. This approach emphasises the challenge at stake for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak as he heads into a general election. Joining us now to dig into this Tory image problem is Dr. Samuel Power, Senior Lecturer in Politics at the University of Sussex. Samuel, are you surprised by these findings?
In many ways, no, because what we know from the history of political campaigning is that political parties and campaigners take advice and are strategic about how they campaign. And what we know about the Conservative Party, for example, is that their brand is very weak at the moment. Let's put it diplomatically, which would suggest that actually individual campaigners would want to distance themselves from that. I'm always thinking about a conversation that was happening when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister, and at that point his personal ratings were actually quite good. In terms of a politician and in terms of a leader of a party. Now, I should say that, relatively speaking, he was on about 0 to 1% approval, but it wasn't in the minuses, and that's good for a leader. The Conservative Party were down at about minus 20 on a good day. The question that was being asked was whether Rishi Sunak could drag the Conservative, pull the Conservative Party up to his level, or whether he would be dragged down to the level of the Conservatives more broadly. And indeed, it's transpired that he's been dragged down. So the fact that conservative candidates are distancing themselves from this party brand suggests that the Conservative brand itself is a problem for campaigners. Is a problem for campaigners because voters are increasingly unconvinced by the Conservatives as a party.
Okay, as someone who looks closely then at, you know, advertising spend around elections, what do you think is going to happen for this election cycle, for the general election, in terms of how much money goes to social media, what the breakdown is? What do you think that the Conservatives, sort of based perhaps on the last elections, are going to spend their money on this time?
So what we know, having looked at advertising spend for the last 10, 15 years, is that spending online is rising exponentially. The first person to spend any real money online, first party, was the Scottish Green Party in 2011 on Facebook. You can find that in the Electoral Commission database. I'm the kind of nerdy person that can tell you that kind of information. But what we know is that from about 2015, spending ratcheted up. And in 2019, all parties' advertising budget, about 80% of that was spent online. So we know that online is going to be the new advertising battleground. There'll be a few billboards, of course. There'll be other offline adverts, if you will, but it will be being spent online. I think there's an extent to which, despite Meta or Facebook sort of dominates the discourse or has dominated the discourse, even in 2019, we were seeing political parties moving away from Facebook, or specifically, we were seeing the Conservative Party moving away from Facebook. So the Conservative Party spent a lot of money, about half of their online budget, if you will, on Meta, on Facebook. But they spent the other 50% on Google, specifically YouTube adverts. Those banner adverts that you see when you watch a video that, that you click skip on after 20 seconds, or at least I do. So they were spending a lot of money there. The Labour Party were spending most of their money on Meta, as were parties like the Green Party. I would expect that tells us that parties will be increasingly moving on from Facebook. Not sure quite how much, because it's a bit harder to analyse, but we will see more, for example, TikTok advertising. Twitter, you couldn't pay for adverts in 2019. It's an open question, but I suspect not in 2024. But I would expect still Facebook dominating the marketplace, but people moving to YouTube and actually increasingly moving to TikTok in 2024.
One of the sort of fascinations of an online campaign compared to a sort of, you know, more traditional one is you can have multiple messages going out to multiple different sort of constituencies at the same time. I don't know how closely you're watching this at the moment, Dr. Powers, but like, how far can we tell what kind of electorate Labour and the Conservatives are trying to target by who and where they're putting their adverts?
Yeah, so at this stage, it's incredibly hard to analyse it. As we move closer to the election, and indeed post the election, we get a better sense of how the parties were targeting. Part of the problem is that actually Facebook or Meta, they have what let's call it the best advertising archive in terms of being able to analyse what's going on, but it's still not great. So it's hard to get that segmented targeting data to really see who was targeting what and why. Also, as you say, what's happening at the moment in terms of the online advertising space is that what parties are doing at the moment is precisely their message testing. So they are pumping out, you know, 70 different versions of a very similar advert, and they will be producing what we call A-B tests, so ever so slightly different messaging, targeting at ever so slightly different demographics and seeing what sticks. This is really what the online world offers you that the offline world doesn't. Online advertising is dirt cheap compared to traditional advertising. A little bit of money can go an incredibly long way, particularly at this stage when you're really trying to get that message right. So what we're seeing in the archives at the moment, or what we're seeing at the moment, is essentially political parties flooding the marketplace, if you will, so that they can really get a sense of what works and why and how. And then once that has been sort of whittled down in terms of an election campaign, we'll get a much better idea about what parties then want to target. For example, although, you know, probably didn't take a true electoral soothsayer to garner this, but in the 2019 election, what we saw was the Conservatives really, really hammering Jeremy Corbyn, for example, because they knew he was very, very bad for the Labour Party. Talk about a toxic brand, right? So they would have developed that sort of message testing over time, but it was relatively simple. But then you can also see different elements of the NHS, Brexit, that kind of thing in the Conservative Party ads from 2019, for example.
It's fascinating that then the message that seems to be being tested at the moment is one that doesn't involve Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Samuel Power, for joining us on the podcast today. That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Marufal Hussain. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm James Wilcock. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.